So, do you know how you sent me the ebook of Slade House?
Oh, yeah.
And the first time you sent it, and I said, oh, there's nothing attached, do it again. Look at my email. Look how many there are.
26?
Like, every 2 or 3 days.
Why the fuck was it sending it to you 26 times?
It's still going. Like, every 2 or 3 days, I get this little email with the subject line, Slade House. And an attachment that isn't really attachment and that's called No Name. So I'm being haunted.
Do you think it's haunted? Yeah.
I'm being haunted by a Slade House ebook.
I wouldn't even know how to stop it.
So this will go on forever? Like, when I die, there'll be like 10,852 emails that say Slade House, No Name attachment.
So it's still happening?
Yeah, the last one was today. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and with me is my co-host, Ian Mond. Hi, Ian.
Hello.
We're back to monthly.
Yes.
See, I changed it.
I know.
How are you?
Good.
How's summer?
Actually, it's been quite mild.
Well, it's mild inside your air-conditioned house.
Yeah, no. Well, how many 40-plus days have it been?
Yes, don't speak too soon. Knock on all the
way. Why have we started this podcast talking about the weather?
I don't know.
That's like the most banal way to start anything. Maybe that's a foreshadowing and what we're going to be discussing. Maybe the weather is a more interesting topic. Anyway, please.
What are we discussing? We are picking, well, we have picked two books, sort of bouncing off an article that I read in The Guardian last year, written by...
Damien Walter. It is. It's written by Damien Walter.
You didn't even read it till this morning.
I didn't read
you're
it.
An authority.
I didn't read it until 3 minutes ago.
So, no, that article about Damien Walter. Oh, yes, I'm familiar with that. Yes. which is basically about the tired old, you know, literature versus genre and which has better books and which authors might be, you know, appropriating which tropes and so on and so on. But it's a short article and it lands pretty much where I guess we would both land in that, you know, it's kind of a false line to be drawing and there's a lot more, you know, in common between so-called literary and so-called genre novels.
It's a line.
Each side can have good books and bad books.
Yeah, but it's a line that both marketers, publishers and authors are desperate to keep drawing.
Yeah.
For whatever reason.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because he pokes fun at Colson Whitehead and Glenn Duncan, who are clearly writing genre novels, but pretend they aren't.
Yeah, and it is interesting. But so we'll link to that in the show notes so you can go ahead and read the whole thing. But I'll just read a couple of key quotes. As I said, he's talking about literature versus genre, and one of the sentences I particularly liked was that where he's talking about how there's not really a qualitative difference between, you know, overall between genre fiction and literary fiction. And yet he says, the literary world is determined to claim, even while it's stealing genre's clothes, that it somehow wears them better. Which I really quite liked. And that is the claim that you do see bandied about a lot. And when we get to talking about Slade House, I have a review from which I will liberally quote because it proves that argument just beautifully.
Which one? Because I read a few reviews.
Well, we'll get to that, Ian.
Oh, is that a spoiler? Don't, okay.
Just stop it.
Okay, sorry.
Stop it. Just there's a structure.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And he also, I guess he surmises the landscape, as it were, by saying that literary authors are the luxury brands of the writing world, whereas genre writers are mid-range consumer brands, which is a really interesting, I guess, metaphor to draw, especially when you consider that books are all the same price, you know?
Yes.
Like, with other, like, luxury versus consumer goods, as he talks about, you know, if you buy a designer couch, it's going to cost you $10,000.
Yes.
If you go down to, you know,
fantastic furniture,
you can buy one for $300.
Yes.
And there's a marked difference between the price. There is also, I don't think this is saying anything, no one doesn't realise, a marked difference between the quality. Now, is there a $10,000 difference between the quality of a designer couch and one from Fantastic Furniture? Probably not. But, you know, you're probably getting a better built couch, maybe.
By the way.
Better materials that will last you longer, of course.
We're not being paid by Fantastic Furniture.
No, that's so, just the thing that popped into Ian's head.
Yes. But you're right, novels cost the same.
But novels are the same. And the quality of the book, the quality of the physical book is the same. right? You can get a nice hardback in any type of genre, and you can get a cheap paperback in any type of genre. So the quality, the physical quality of the books are the same. With digital book, clearly it's the same quality. And the price points are roughly the same. A book costs what a book costs. So
yeah, true.
The
You're
only
right.
way you can kind of leverage this luxury versus consumer goods, as though, you know, luxury items aren't consumed, is by what Damien Walter is arguing, is that you leverage it via this idea of the intellect. And something, you know, literary novels being more intellectually qualitative than consumer books, which are just trashy and no good for you and like McDonald's. But I just find it interesting because it's one of the only, I guess, areas that I can think of where there is clearly a dichotomy between, you know, this idea of good books, quality books, luxury books, you know, intelligent books and all the rest. That's not matched up with price.
No, it's very interesting.
It's really interesting.
I never thought of it that way.
No, I hadn't actually either till I read like the bits I just quoted and went, oh, yeah, I get that metaphor, but oh, wait, no one pays more. I mean, you know, they might pay more for the nice first edition hardback of a first edition David Mitchell than they would for Adam Neville, but maybe not.
Well, no, but if they both come out from hardcover, they're both going to be between $30 to $50.
I know, but I mean, in the subsequent... collectible books market, right? Certain authors will be, books might be worth more, but then I don't know. That's
if there is a collectible book market, the horror genre has a really strong collectible book market, and that stuff goes for shitloads.
So it is really interesting. It is really interesting that you cannot actually make a financial distinction. These books are not deemed inaccessible to the hoi polloi because of their price. Anyone can actually go and buy a David Mitchell book or a David Foster Wallace book, or anyone can buy them. You're not having to, you know, take out a second mortgage on your house, you know.
20th anniversary of Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, a book that you didn't finish for this podcast.
No, I didn't. The book defeated me, and I'd like to say that one day I may get back to it, but I don't think so.
I'm very disappointed. I'm not angry. I'm just disappointed. Yeah. Anyway,
so
but not about
so that was a little bit of a sidetrack, but one I found quite interesting, because if you can't deny access via price, which is how a lot of our class-structured signifiers are, right? Not everybody can afford the $10,000 couch or the $200,000 Mercedes-Benz, right? So they're restricted because of financial access. You can't restrict books.
No, but if you create an artificial intellectual obstacle, you frighten the hoi polloi away from the literary novel.
That's right.
You say to them, look, you're not going to get this. You're just not going to understand it.
And if you do read it and don't understand it, it's your fault.
Correct, because you're not...
you're not smart enough to appreciate this kind of a book. Yeah, it's interesting. I think that's a discussion worth teasing out, but not today, because...
Why not? Oh, no, because we've talked about the books.
Because we need to talk about the books. Okay. But, yeah, I do find, as I said, the artificial barriers that get constructed to support the idea of a genuine qualitative difference, which I don't think can actually be supported. But anyway, so bouncing off that article, because Damien Walter did talk about Slade House as an example, I guess it was just published before the article came out in November.
He says, yep. Damien Walter, Slade House is the latest to blunder through the electric barriers erected around the safe zone.
Referring to literary versus genre.
Correct. Yep. So Mitchell has gone, and he's written Slade House.
Yeah, may have got a bit singed going through that barrier.
Except... the thing is that Mitchell himself is a genre geek. He's not. Yeah. He's not wandered anywhere. He knows where he's going. But anyway, that's let's get.
And so that's what I thought. Well, you know, I hadn't read any David Mitchell. Why don't I read Slade House? Possibly in retrospect, not the best idea. Spoilers.
Well, no, not the best place to start in retrospect. I should have warned you.
You should have warned me.
But I didn't.
Anyway, we'll get to it. And then Ian randomly picked.
You said to me. Let's pick a book that has a similar theme, that is a genre author.
Spooky house kind of story.
Well, I had not read Adam Neville.
No, it's fine. You're already so defensive.
Very, very defensive, because I inflicted this book upon myself, not just you. Spoilers. Yes.
Yes.
And actually, they are very thematically similar.
Yeah, interestingly enough, in terms of theme, they dovetail quite nicely. So it was a good choice from that perspective. They work well. You didn't choose a book that we've gone, well, we've got nothing to compare them to. So that's what we read. We read Slade House by David Mitchell and The House of Small Shadows by Adam Neville. Neither of which authors I'd actually come across before, though I had been meaning to read Cloud Atlas since Ian reviewed it like a decade ago or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's still sitting
you
on my shelf.
You haven't seen the film?
No, because I waited to read the book.
Okay. I actually like the film quite a lot.
So maybe I'll just see the film and be done with that. So
No, read the book. No. I like the film, but seriously, read the book.
And then it might be another Mitchell's... 10 years before I get around to reading. Okay. If you're going to say it fits into Mitchell's Uber novel.
No. Forget the Uber novel. He's over, his general... Cloud Atlas is a really good example of Mitchell who writes essentially a bunch of linked novellas, then calls it a novel.
Yes. Let's move on. Okay. So I thought we'd talk about the Neville first and then move on to the Mitchell.
Okay.
So hold that thought about the linked novellas because I want to come back to that.
Okay.
As per
But just make it clear, we chose a so-called literary novel. So genre,
yes.
Doing the same things, but one from a literary side and
one that was
from...
clearly marketed and reviewed around and everything as a literary novel.
Correct.
Dabbling in genre.
Because you'll note that the Guardian review for both these books is to Liz Jensen did the Guardian review for Slade House, but it was Jeff Vandermeer, a genre writer, who did the Adam Neville.
Yes.
So both reviewed in the same...
In the same market.
Market, but they didn't pick a genre reviewer.
Reviewed by a genre...
Yeah, so the Neville was a genre reviewer, a literary reviewer for the so-called literary novel.
Yeah, so it is straight down the line, and that makes sense. You know, when you're a review marketplace, you do farm out the books to review to people who think, you know, will appreciate them and the sensibilities.
But this is the point of this podcast.
And,
that's why this podcast is in existence, because it's taking that idea of the literary versus genre, where both are essentially writing in the same sort of thing, but how it's treated differently.
True.
Now, Adam Neville.
Oh, Adam Neville. I'm just going to say straight out that I will never read another Adam Neville book, ever.
I would like to say that
based
I'm in the same...
on The House of Small Shadows.
I'm in the same place. I will never pick up another Adam Neville. I'm sorry, Adam, but...
I...
Actually, if you are a fan of Adam Neville's work...
You probably skip ahead.
If you're either A, Adam Neville, or a fan of Adam Neville's work, I would go to
skip ahead.
Yeah.
Skip ahead. And if you don't send us hate mail. I feel so bad because there's not much.
Why do you feel
there's
bad?
There's just not much good I can say. There's one good thing. There was a really funny joke in the middle.
Was there a joke?
It was a really, really funny joke that made me laugh out loud, which doesn't happen often. And it was when the main character, Catherine, who is in the middle of a depressive, drunken week, gets a text message from some marketing company and she just texts them back, cunt.
Yeah.
And I was like, that was the one bright spot in the whole book for me. So that's the good.
The cover's great.
So let's go back.
The cover is great.
The cover's fine, but we don't talk about covers.
Okay. Yes, let's go back.
Let's go back. So the basic story of The House of Small Shadows is that you have an antiques dealer or someone who works for an antiques dealer who is assigned to go to this old dilapidated house called the Red House and assess a part of a collection of she's told dolls that the current owner of the house and descendant of the person who sort of had the collection is having to sell because she's fallen on hard times. And that's a fair summation of the setup, I guess.
It is, except the fact that the collection she's looking at, which is dolls but then becomes dioramas, is
puppets.
Done by a famous taxidermist.
Yes.
W.H. Mason.
W.H. Mason, yeah. Well, a crypto sort of taxidermist, possibly.
Crypto?
In the end, yeah. Well, likes those different bits together. But yeah, so... And his sanity is in question almost.
we never really meet him.
Well, he's dead.
Yes, he's well. Well, is he?
But
who knows?
Oh, yeah, well, this is true. Who does know? That's the basic setup. And Catherine, our protagonist, has had a traumatic past. She's adopted. She was bullied when she was a child. She grew up in a very low-income housing estate area in the UK.
Her friend Alice went missing.
Was presumed, her and some other children presumed, kidnapped by a serial killer slash child killer.
Yep.
Back when Catherine was growing up. One of the effects of her childhood trauma was that she suffers from what she calls like trances, and she just sort of blanks out and has these sort of nightmarish, dreamlike reflections.
What the fuck was going on with those trances? Because I thought for a moment it was some sort of psychic thing, or because she's having visions associated with them. But no, it's
vaguing out. It's and daydreaming nightmarishly, I guess. Day nightmares.
Is that a thing though? Like, given it's not a supernatural.
No, I don't think it's a thing. But anyway, so that this is the setup for the story.
Yeah.
As I said, I have nothing really good to say about this book. I think on a strict prose level, the writing I think is just terrible.
Oh, I get the feeling that he's trying to ape a certain style, maybe, and because Thomas the Goddard gets mentioned both by him at the end of the book and by reviewers who I'm not entirely sure have actually read Thomas the Goddard, but
I was about to say Thomas the Goddard. Yeah, he's Baroque. And his writing style, can be
purple.
You know, some people would say over the top and so on. But he can put a sentence together. Like, he knows where the bits of the sentence go.
But your concern was the many adjectives, of which they're everywhere. You know,
it's very...
A doorknob is not a doorknob, it's a well-crafted doorknob.
It's not even a well... Let me read you the doorknob.
Did we highlight the same bit independently about a doorknob? Because it just jumped out at me that nothing is just a doorknob.
Nothing is just anything. And this is the problem, because nothing is anything. You don't know what's important.
And Adam Neville would say, you're not meant to know.
No, that's rubbish. It's just bad writing. Okay, so let me read you the doorknob, because that was I highlighted so much.
We haven't spoken to each other about this.
It's just when you read that, I went, oh God, I remember that sentence. So let me preface this by saying there is nothing important about this door handle.
No, nothing.
Like, there's nothing important about it. But here's the sentence. Catherine reached for the brass handle set within an escutcheon of metal in an oval shape.
That's right. Yeah,
she just reaches for a door handle. And then this happens over and over again throughout this book. You have these really, it's not even like it's such a strained description anyway.
I know what the argument's going to be. That Catherine is not a collector. She's a surveyor's not the right word. What's the word?
She's kind of working. She's working for an antique dealer and valuer, so I guess she's a valuer.
She's quite new
to the profession.
She's a valuer, and she's new to the profession, but she obviously has an eye for...
This is a third of the way through the book.
Well, wait a sec. She obviously has an eye for collectibles and beautiful things, and therefore in her world, that's how she describes everything. Except for the fact it makes for really hard, dull reading.
Yeah, it does. And as I said, it's not as though... I mean, that's just a really clunky sentence. It's a really clunky sentence. And the other thing that did annoy... Like, the vocabulary is really careless. The thing that jumped out at me first, which is on page one or two, I mean, it was... And again, I guess I'll read it in the interests of... veracity, just so people know I'm not making this up. So it is on the second page, actually. And she's coming up to the house for the first time.
This is the red house.
This is her impression of the house. Her first impression was of a building enraged at being disturbed, rearing up at the sight of her between the gateposts. Twin chimney breasts, one per wing, mimicked arms flung upwards to claw the air. Now... A chimney breast is an architectural feature that is inside a house. It's the part of the hearth that sticks out into the room.
Okay. Right? I actually didn't know that.
It's that bit that comes out. And it's
Did you know this before? Okay.
And it's called a chimney breast because back in the day when there were hearths and chimneys and that's how everyone heated their house and cooked their food. Well, no, because back in the day, breast simply referred to a chest.
Okay.
These days, which is the problem, because these days, in 2015, the word breast has shifted to pretty much talk about the female anatomy.
Yes.
That's where it is. And then when you couple it with twin chimney breasts, that's the image that it immediately conjures in the reader's head.
His boobies on the top.
And the thing is, all he's talking about are the chimneys, because it's outside the house and they're the two chimneys reaching up like arms.
So they're not even chimney breasts.
They're not even chimney breasts. Mm. And he's, that's what I mean. He's using these, like, a lot of the time the vocabulary just doesn't suit the point you made about, well, Catherine's a valuer, she notices things. In which case, if this is all meant to be her point of view, which I would argue against, then she's getting a lot of shit wrong. She's not very good at her job. I mean, there was another thing later in the novel where, again, it's this over-describing. Catherine and her partner, Mike, are at a restaurant, and they're being served by a waitress, and they're having a bit of a tiff, and the waitress walks away. And again, the waitress is not important. What the waitress is wearing is not important. And yet he goes great pains to describe the waitress walking away on black ballet pumps.
Oh, I remember that
now,
too, yeah.
Pumps are a heeled shoe. You can't have a ballet pump. And more to the point, there's no reason to be describing the waitress's footwear. Or the metal oval that the brass door handle is
but
in.
Isn't that
or any of these
I don't know why I'm bothering to play devil's advocate here, but and I'm not even doing
they're
a good job.
So distracting.
Isn't that the whole Ligotti, as I'm now saying,
no,
vibe? Because it gives that sense of, wow, that's off-putting.
No, there's off-putting when something is not quite right in the world, right? If the waitress
waitress wearing ballet pumps isn't quite right.
If the waitress was wearing 6-inch patent leather stilettos, that's not quite right in the world.
Okay, yep.
But patent leather 6-inch stiletto heels can exist in the world. It's just a waitress wouldn't be wearing them. Black ballet pumps are things which don't exist in the world.
Are you
and
sure
I don't
of this?
Think.
Are you sure of this?
Yes, I am sure of this.
Okay.
You know, like, it's just this careless vocabulary. And they're just two examples. And there were others where it things which may not necessarily be precisely incorrect as much as the chimney breasts, and which is going to be my new favourite thing now, chimney breasts. and the ballet pumps, they're kind of the wrong word. Just the wrong word. They have the wrong connotations for what I'm presuming, and I'm presuming generously that the way they're employed is meant to provoke.
Being ignorant of such things, I don't know what a ballet pump is, and I don't know I didn't know what chimney breast. I thought he was just describing chimneys.
No, and the thing is, these are the things which jump out at me.
Yes.
Now, there's got to be other stuff in there which I don't know that are jumping out at other people who are going, oh, but, well, that's not an Etruscan.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there'll be other stuff in there that I haven't picked up on because I'm unaware.
For me, it was just too hard to engage with any part of the novel, partly because of the prose and partly because of Catherine herself.
Yeah, Catherine as a character, she there's a review I read, and I honestly can't remember which one it was now, but points out that that Catherine just runs at one speed. She's hysterical.
I wrote it down as in my notes as miserable. But you're right.
But she is, like, from the beginning, yeah. Like, there's so many instances, and I'm not exaggerating to say there's got to be at least 2 dozen throughout the whole thing where she's, she thinks she's about to scream, she thinks she might pass out, she thinks she'll faint. There's one where she thought if something happened, she'd have a seizure. I mean, it's so.
But it's from the beginning. There's no lead up to
this. That's what I mean.
This.
It's from the beginning.
And again, the argument is she's had a pretty tough life. She's just come from a situation in London where she's essentially belted the crap out of her producer on a show and that. And you know, it's and her boyfriend is now, well, that happens later, but her boyfriend is leaving her. So she's just a sad, miserable woman. But you're right, even when she's in the very early part, when the only time we see her being vaguely competent, just because she's never competent in the novel,
she's
at
never
any
competent,
point,
no.
But she's vaguely competent when she turns up to that hotel room with all the dolls in it. A scene that really makes no sense once you've finished the book. I don't get what the point of that scene was. She's looking at all the dolls and seems to know what they are and how much they'd be worth and all that. But even in that scene, there's this feeling like she's about to scream and you get...
Well, it's not the feeling, Ian. Like, it's no feeling that she's about to scream. The paragraph actually says, even if she were the only living thing in the room, she remained as still as the dolls and returned their glassy stares. If anything moved, she would let go of the shriek that had built like a sneeze. Again, really awkward description there.
But that aside, why?
But she's about to shriek, right? Because the dolls might move. I mean, like, it's from the start and it's all the way through. She's one note. She's always about to just have a complete nervous breakdown or scream or faint or have a fucking seizure.
And rather than go to a therapist or get some sort of help, she decides to just keep punishing herself by going back to the red house.
But as you, like, just going back 30 seconds, like you say, well, what's that thing in the hotel? I think that it highlights one of the structural problems with the novel, because it's not just the, and honestly, it, like, guys, I'm not being mean. It's such bad prose. But there's also a structural issue. So you have chapter one, which is Catherine turning up at the red house with the chimney breasts. And
she gets to see.
And honestly, we have 6 pages of description of this house.
Yes, yes.
And like, I'm not exaggerating. 6 pages of
groan,
description.
Tell me this. Did you groan when there was a face pressed up against the mirror?
Yes,
the window?
There's a face pressed up against the window.
The great horror, haunted house cliche.
And it's nothing that's ever undermined or, you know, treated ironically.
It's not ironically. It's not that in a self-aware way.
But anyway, right, so 6 pages of a description of a house, which, and I kid you not, it's... As, you know, it's just purple. And then she finally knocks on the door, like it's the longest walk ever. And someone opens the door and there's a voice or something that says something. Bang! Cut to chapter 2 weeks earlier. And then you have like 4 or 5 chapters of 2 weeks earlier, which begins with her arriving at this hotel to look at this room of dolls, and there's no one there. And you finally get up to chapter 5 or 6 or whatever it is, and then she's going back to the house. But why? Why pull out that, like... You have a chapter where you've got a character who's very much on the edge going up to a hotel room to look at dolls, which are inherently creepy anyway. Probably not enough to make me shriek as though I was building up to a
sneeze. She's expecting the dolls. It's not like she's walking
into she's expecting the dolls. But no one's there, like, which is a bit odd. I mean, there's enough in that first chapter to actually be...
Start the novel with that chapter?
To start the novel with that chapter. Yeah. Why throw this other thing... It's just a cheap
because the
stunt.
House is an
it's a cheap stunt.
It is, but the, well, yes,
it
but
is.
The house
it's
is
cheap.
An integral part of the book. So start with the house, end with the house.
But you do not have to go with 6 pages of exposition about the fucking house. But you know what? Like, structurally.
Yep. Look, we spoke about this before we recorded. Chapter 39. I'll never forget chapter 39.
Chapter 39.
Chapter 39 is when, and it's, you know, obviously spoilers. Chapter 39 is a thing where, frankly, I could see coming from a mile off. By the way. Just a slight thing. You know she's adopted pretty early on. Were you not screaming at the book saying, Maud is the mother! Maud is the mother! Maud is the mother! Maud is the mother! Guess who the mother is? I think it's Maud.
Maud. Maud. The mannish Maud.
Yeah.
How many times do you want to describe this woman as mannish? The mannish drudge.
I know people.
Oh, the gender politics in this book are just.
Well, because you've also
wonderful.
Got, I will get to chapter 39 in a sec, but you've also got this cliched, oh, fuck, the daughter of Mason, just this old wizard woman.
Oh,
anyway, but let me get to chapter 39.
I actually didn't mind Edith to start with, because I thought the book was setting her up to be this kind of Miss Havisham character and... Again, like Catherine, she was one note. She
Correct.
Just stayed there. There was
Correct.
No kind of revealing
but
of...
chapter 39...
Sorry, yes, chapter 39.
38 chapters of Catherine. And
oh, that's...
And 6 chapters after that of Catherine. But suddenly, because Adam Neville, as you said correctly, doesn't know how to do it any other way, suddenly throws in a chapter through the perspective of
Leonard
who is Catherine's boss.
Wheelchair... Oh, well, we think he's the wheelchair-bound boss. He's actually the evil person who's impersonating someone who's in a wheelchair.
Correct.
And who's also fat and wears a toupee.
Which has all sorts
of probably never had
disability-related issues around that.
Oh, my God, just the words around Leonard. There's this whole bit where Catherine, you know, she goes, oh, how sad that my only friend is some guy in a wheelchair and a toupee.
Correct. Oh, my God. That actually...
Mamie did not like Catherine at all.
Well, putting aside that... The way disability is dealt with in this novel is fucking
but
awful.
But it's okay, Ian, because he's not really disabled.
No, he gets up on his legs and then takes off
And I can
his...
see that would be the argument, right? That's the argument, that he's not really disabled, therefore it's actually not bad
Everyone,
about disability.
Up until chapter 39, when he appears suddenly from his perspective, everyone thinks he's disabled. Well,
yeah,
he
and all the descriptions of him. There's a bit where Catherine actually wonders if anyone had ever loved him. Why? Because he's in a wheelchair?
Correct, yeah.
Like, it's just... But the fact that then
but
he's...
don't make someone getting up from a wheelchair your big twist.
That's your big twist.
And he also
well, not, not only that he's getting up from the wheelchair,
but
he's
the
not
point
really
is...
But the thing is...
Because Adam Neville can't structurally tell you the story without... And that's bullshit.
But
You could have taken that chapter out. It still would have worked.
It's a structural problem anyway, because he's basically, the reveal is that Leonard is the one who actually kidnapped the children years ago and has been orchestrating Catherine's life so that she comes back to the Red House, because you do that in such a convoluted fucking way.
Yeah, why wait 20 years to get her back to the Red House if she's so important?
Why he decided to be in a wheelchair, I don't know. Part of his clever disguise.
For Doctor Who fans, it's a bit like the Master turning up in Peter Davison's Doctor Who era dressed in a disguise, which was so fucking obvious. It's just for no apparent purpose.
But anyway, and so the actual where the reveal should be is when Leonard actually turns up to the house in the van at the very end when Catherine's trying to get away on 2 feet with no wheelchair, and that would have actually been I think it's sort of been on the nose in regard to all of the crap around Leonard's depiction up until that point, but that would have been the actual reveal. But he gives it to us early by saying, oh, who the guy was. Now let's watch him turn up at the Red House. It's like, why would you?
It must have been an editor telling him, saying, look, I don't think people are going to. Look, it's possible this has happened, and complete speculation. The ending is, and I put this in scare quotes, ambiguous. Well, anyway, the ending is very, very ambiguous in its way. It makes no sense, frankly.
I don't think that's ambiguous. I think it just makes no sense.
Okay, it's possible that an editor has said, well, if you want to keep that, you've got to explain what Leonard's role in this is. Because you get 7 or 8 pages of this, and Leonard, and there's fucking W.H. Mason chanting in the background about how to do taxidermy, and it's a whole ritual, which makes no fucking sense, and he's taken off his toupee, and I don't know, oh, God, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, it is ridiculous, and again, what it serves...
And he gets nude. Of course he gets nude.
Of course he gets nude. I'm surprised he didn't start rubbing butter on himself or something. But, of course, what it also effectively does in terms of the architecture of the book is it... remember how I talked about in The Unnamed Midwife? Those sections that were outside of the knowledge of the midwife character, things about some characters she'd come across that later on and she couldn't possibly ever have known what happened to them. And I said, as interesting as those bits were, I didn't like them in the novel because what it did was give us a privileged position above the midwife, and suddenly we would know stuff that she wouldn't know, and we would get a consolation or a closure that she never would get. And I didn't like that. I liked one of the strengths of that book was that we were on the level of the midwife character for the whole thing, and we didn't know what she didn't know, and we didn't get closure if she didn't get it. And those chapters kind of broke that, and And that's exactly what this chapter with Leonard does. So as you pointed out, all the other 40-odd chapters are all... they're ostensibly Catherine's point of view, although, as I said, I think there's some slippage there, but it's intended to be from Catherine's point of view, I think. So then suddenly getting this knowledge, which isn't hers, puts us again in this privileged position. We now know that Leonard's a bad guy. We now know when he turns up later at the house, it's no good. We know all this, and Catherine doesn't. And for a book which is, I guess, purporting to put us alongside Catherine for almost... its entirety, and to be unnerved and scared and disturbed when she is and scared for her, suddenly we're like, oh, no, here's something you don't know, Catherine, that we do. And it kind of breaks that.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I would have quite happy if she'd fallen into a tar pit. But
the feeling
had been lost. But you're right.
I'm not saying
structurally.
That.
Structurally, yes. Structurally, it just does not make any sense.
No, it's this ridiculous chapter that... And it, as you said, there's no point to it. There's just no point
and
to it.
It is just a random bundle of set pieces. I mean, there's stuff that goes on in the village, which is just, this essentially deserted village where...
It's kind of the Wicker Man sort of thing.
Yeah, it's the Wicker Man thing. It tries to
And there's
to
nothing
mesh.
Wrong with that.
No, but it doesn't
Except I don't
fit.
Think...
It takes you...
I don't think the book handles it particularly well.
Because if the focus is the Red House... We go and spend 50 pages in a village of weird people or weird
shit
going
were, on. I guess,
in a
supplicants,
church.
Supplicants yeah, it, to the weird, to the Red
none
House
of which
and its
is,
people.
None of which is.
But and, again,
and
there's
again,
no... There's
none
no...
of which is explained, and I don't mind that it's not explained entirely because I don't need everything doled out to me, but it just feels there for effect. It feels there for...
It does.
It doesn't feel like there's a point to any of it. And, of course, what happens, the big fucking haunted house cliche, which Mitchell does as well to a degree, is that the victim gets caught in the cogs of the house itself and becomes not just goes from victim to, in a sense, the one who's pulling the cogs at the
end. Complicit.
Yeah, complicit. Yeah. God, how many times have I fucking seen that cliche?
And it wasn't even done well. And I, again, as I've said so many times on this podcast, I don't think as an author you can acknowledge something crap in your book and be okay with that. So having your character, Catherine, say, oh, I know I shouldn't be going back to the house, I should just be leaving, but that's not enough.
That happens at least three times.
I know. It's like you can't acknowledge the ludicrousness of this situation and actions by having the character acknowledge it and then provide no substantial... You know, it is really ridiculous.
I don't give a fuck how broken, miserable, hysterical, or strange she is.
But that's all she is.
She's one note.
All she is.
But even with the one noteness of her character, there is no logical reason to go back to the house.
No. She's got to go back to save Mike.
Well, actually,
she doesn't even have to do that. She's got to go back because she told Mike she'd meet him at the house.
Which makes even less sense. The house itself, and again, a bit like Mitchell, the house itself warps reality. So
yeah.
So the house that she actually seems to be in for most of the novel isn't actually the house that exists in the real world. The house that exists in the real world is dilapidated and falling apart.
Yes. So she's gone in and she's making a lot of comments about how amazing the house is and the decor and the furniture and, my God, it must be worth a fortune because it's all in perfect condition and pristine and amazing. And, you know, to Neville's credit, I didn't pick that wasn't the case.
But it's an old trick again, because Mitchell does it himself.
Whereby
two things: you need to be invited into the place of the house to see it, to enter the reality bubble, and the fact that it's in its own reality bubble.
Yeah. And this need to have the victims be complicit in their own demise,
correct,
as it were. You know, she was given plenty of chances to leave. She was asking
the
for
reason
it.
I raise that is that in the reviews of, and I know we haven't got to the Slade House, but we'll get there. But in the reviews of Slade House, there is this talk about, well, at least one of them I remember might have been Dwight Gardner or one of the independent reviews saying, well, he's done nothing new here. It's just, you know, it's a Horton House novel, and we've seen this all before. Yet you go to the reviews of Neville, and the feeling is that this is
it's amazing.
Oh my God, you've blown my mind.
Yeah, no, there was
the spectacular set pieces,
the excellent writing, the scariness.
Put the writing aside because I think those people are just completely insane. but also the thing, that stuff with the dioramas and da 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 da. And he's doing such interesting, innovative new things.
And I think he's not. The thing is, I think that set dressing, as it were, the creepy dioramas with the, you know, hundreds and thousands of stuffed rats that he makes into these World War One dioramas, and the crazy puppets that he makes.
Being Mason.
I think all of that, it's a really cool idea. It really is. Like, it's some of the potential imagery at the core of this book.
Not the way it's written, though.
No, I'm saying some of the potential imagery available to this story at the core of the book is actually really, it could be genuinely creepy, but it's just not. Like, the writing, as I've seen, I'm sorry to harp on about it, but the writing is just so, so bad. The writing isn't scary. The writing doesn't provoke anything approaching dread or discomfort or disquiet, because as a reader, I'm just constantly being reminded that I'm reading this really clunky book.
To be fair, you are Kirsten.
Does that make it fair?
No. Not to say that you're some sort of Uber reader.
Am I a literary reader?
But, well, you're an elitist when it comes to this sort of thing. And you've already used the term hoi polloi once.
Okay. Can I read you a paragraph? Can I read you a paragraph?
All right.
I use the word hoi polloi ironically, Ian, as well you know.
Yes.
Lennon had an eye for a strange beauty in the artifacts they valued and sold, in the same way he noticed things about her, or one sentence, comma splice. Little things she couldn't possibly identify through the opaque fog that worrying about her weight often enshrouded her within. That's not me being picky. That's a bad couple of sentences. And it's like that on almost every page. Like, the sentences are just badly constructed and awkward to read, and you have to often read them a couple of times to get the sense of what they're saying. And it's not because they're dense. It's not because they're multi-clause sentences filled with levels of meaning that you've got to decode. They're just bad sentences.
I agree.
And when I'm talking about the writing being at that level,
the difference between him and Ligotti, who everyone is.
And that's what I said to you. And that when I'm talking about the writing being bad, I don't just mean he uses a lot of adjectives or he uses purple metaphors. I'm talking about on a sentence level, the writing is hard to read because it's bad. And I can't put it any other way, and I can't sugarcoat it.
I
just got so angry reading this book because I'm just being made to read this terrible, terrible prose. It was like wading through tar with like sharp bits in it.
I picked Neville because he's a award-winning writer.
Yes!
I think nearly every one of his novels gets nominated for something, whether it's
a
British Fantasy Award or a World Fantasy Award or, you know, a Shirley Jackson. I don't know if he's been nominated for a Shirley Jackson specifically, but he's an award-nominated author. And I suppose, you know, we all have different tastes, we all have different views, but I don't get it. I don't. Yes.
Catherine was compelled to return the smile, though her body felt ready to shatter like the porcelains at an end of the mantle that the two stoats in convict uniforms were entwined about.
Yes, it's a bad sentence. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. I actually gave it 2 stars on Goodreads only because I finished it.
That was generous.
I was being generous. I may change that.
Like, I give it 1 star for the weird taxidermy. one star for the cuff joke.
It does make me depressed, and maybe this is the elitist part of me or the cultural snobbery that I have and that you have. We both have. We are cultural snobs to a degree.
I saw Star Wars and liked it, I'll have
this,
you know.
Well, this novel, Adam Neville's not alone. I've read others like this.
I know. I haven't actually read anything this bad on a prose level for a long time. Okay, maybe I'm just not reading the right stuff. Or the wrong stuff.
Compare this to the Lisa Hannett we reviewed.
Oh my God.
But the reason I raise that is the Hannett is also a difficult book in terms of its prose, in terms of the subject matter, in terms of the way it tells its story. And yet I can see a lot of people bouncing off the Hannett because of that and yet gobbling this up. And I don't get it.
Yeah, neither do I.
And that may be cultural snobbery on my part.
I think there's, like, as I said just before, there's a difference between prose which is a challenge to read because it is, you know, it is dense or it is multi-layered or you have to make a lot of extra leaps in terms of connectivity and things like that, and stuff which is just not well written. And I'm saying it on a very basic prose level. When I'm reading a book and I'm copy editing the book in my head page by page, it's not a good reading experience.
And let's be honest, I mean, for both of us, if we'd not been doing this podcast,
I would not have got past the first chapter.
I would have probably stopped.
I would have read the first chapter. I would have gotten to the second chapter where it said 2 weeks previously, and I would have closed the book, and that would have been it. I guess the difference, and when you're talking about something like, since you mentioned it, Lisa Hannett's book and something like this, the difference is if you're going through an obstacle course, that's really hard. And there's a lot of like things you have to crawl over and go under, and there are mazes and that's hard to do. But there's a pleasure in that if you're the sort of person who likes obstacle courses.
Yep.
And that's like the Lisa Hannett book and other well written books, no matter how difficult they might be to read. And then going through an obstacle course where there's a pit there with spikes in it and the fence you're meant to climb over actually has a bit of glass that you didn't know about, and the rope that you climb up breaks halfway down because it's a bad rope and the obstacle course is really badly maintained and they don't have a lot of money so they haven't replaced the ropes for a long time. That's the difference, right? There's a difference between something which is just difficult but ultimately satisfying if that's your thing and something that's just badly constructed. And this book is badly constructed, and I will stand by that. And I will argue that on a page-by-page basis with anyone who would choose to.
And that is an offer open up to all our listeners.
Oh, God. Maybe we'll put and that as any a Neville
fan,
level.
Any Adam Neville fan who's got this far can also curse up on that. Yeah. It could be.
And I don't know. Do we need to talk anymore?
No. We've belaboured the point.
We've belaboured the point.
And anyway, it's time to – because it's interesting because the David Mitchell from a prose point of view is, you know.
Are we moving on?
Yes.
We're moving on. So Slate House by David Mitchell.
Yes. So,
the book that inspired the podcast.
Yes. from a prose point of view, it's just – I've read now – this is now – three novels, because this isn't really a novella, it's not a novel. So 2.5 books by Mitchell, and I've never been disappointed by his prose. Putting aside the plot.
Prose work, Mitchell is a fine writer. Like, he really is. I mean, you've got a series of novelettes in this book. Is it five or six? Five?
It's
five,
every, isn't it? Yeah, because it's every 5 years. Yeah. Every 9 years.
Let's give a...
Okay, first off, The Slade House is not a sequel or a prequel. It is a parallel to The Bone Clocks. So if you've read The Bone Clocks, you'll get more out of The Slade House, but you don't necessarily need to have read The Bone Clocks, Kirsten being a person who has not read The Bone Clocks.
I have not.
But The Slade House is essentially is a house...
No, also in London.
Like
with the Neville books set mostly in London.
Yes. This time it's run by a sister and a brother. They are a sister and a brother, aren't they? Who are essentially immortals, but who only maintain their immortality by sucking out the souls of their victims, decanting them, I think is the word that is used. They're special victims. Yeah, they need a certain type of soul.
And gifted soul,
and then they decant it. And
psychic energy.
Correct. And that has to happen every 9 years. So each story...
To the day.
Correct.
Even though, you know, years aren't actually 365 days long, but anyway.
Yes, there's a slight little issue there. But anyway, that's the way the mystical element works. So the first story, I think, is set in 1979.
Yep.
Is that right? Oh, wow. Good work. And then the next stories are 88... 97, 2006, 2015. Okay? Yeah. So every 9 years. And in each one, someone comes to the Slade House, but the first time it's a direct invite of a mother and a son to come to the Slade House because the son is engifted. So it's to decant his soul.
Yes, and they've invited the mother because he's quite young.
Yes, they've invited the mother along and under the pretense that the mother's going to get a chance to sing for a person.
Piano.
Yeah, she's a pianist. Piano, that's right,
she's a gifted pianist who's down on her luck and she's got this invite to come and give
a person. But every story following this one, it's connected to that first. So in the second one, it's a police detective. And again, I shouldn't have done this, but I read The Slade House in January, which is a stupid move. And I thought I'd taken notes, but I hadn't. Anyway. Not relevant. The police detective, is he gifted as well?
He must be.
Which is where it does sort of begin.
But he doesn't seem to display any.
No, and as well.
Except that he sees the picture, but everyone sees the pictures. So I don't know.
That's just one coincidence that annoyed me.
But I guess the idea that
the guy who's searching for them is someone who also happens to have that special soul. But then after him, it's essentially. So it becomes because the mother and son are seen by another person entering the Slade House and never coming out.
Yep.
And so that guy gets older and tells his nephew or something, who then brings her the paranormal.
And there was also the guy who told the police, which is why the cop is there.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, and it just so there there are connections interleaving other connections that put this together as five very closely connected stories, aside from the fact that they all take place in the same spot.
Well, they follow a chronologically linear narrative.
Correct. Yeah.
So, here's the thing that happened 9 years later. Here's the other thing that happened. Then nothing happens in the intervening years.
And you really couldn't separate them out as short pieces on their own. They do rely on...
I think most of them...
Except the first possibly.
I think the first one is the best story.
Well, it was actually written as a Twitter story.
Yeah, I saw that in my research, and then
it was rewritten for this. So that's the only one that you could take out.
I think the first one was really I've read a lot of reviews since, and reviewers seem to really love the middle one about Sally Timms, which I'm lukewarm on. I think the first one with the young boy Nathan and his mum is the best of them. That may just be because you don't know what's happening yet. You know, you've started the book. This is the first story, so you have no idea what's happening. Yeah. You have no idea that the house is run by these twins. You have no idea that they can shape the house and set up these very detailed traps for the people they're wanting to do.
Very similar to the dioramas in the Neville.
Very similar to the dioramas and the puppet shows.
Yes, puppet shows. Yep. You know, we didn't talk about the puppets at all. Can I just stop there?
I did say puppets.
But that's a key part. That's a key part of the Neville.
Yeah.
The whole puppets and the dolls, the puppets. We barely talked about it. Do you know why? Because it makes no fucking sense. And it never comes out clearly. No. Anyway, back to the Mitchell.
I think, as I said, maybe it's because it is the first story, so it benefits from, as a reader, you don't know what's happening. So you there's some disquiet and discomfort and just trying to figure out what is happening in this story. And then from then on, the rest of them, you know what's happening because they're the same thing.
Yeah, and this is where the
And
book,
I really
where...
didn't appreciate that. I didn't feel like it was doing – and he wasn't even hiding it. Even when, like, in the pub story, which is the second to last one, where the sister of a girl who was taken earlier in the book is investigating what happened, and she's a journalist now, and she's come to interview the guy whose uncle was the guy who reported the people missing. Anyway, and she meets him in a pub, and from the very early on in this story, there's a couple little things where you go, oh, okay, so he's not in the pub, she's in the house. Because he drops these little, very, like, to me, very clear hints that, she's not in the pub, she's in the house. So there's not even that attempt to,
but it is the only one that is actively trying to confuse the reader after three.
But he's not really, because he drops these hints that you know well, you've means,
picked them
oh,
up. I picked them up. I mean, it's clearly the
it's
house.
Clear. It's clear. It's so clear. And I don't know whether.
And you're constantly waiting for the penny to drop.
Yes, and I don't know whether to be grateful that he's not treating me like an idiot and trying to pretend that it isn't the house, but oh, hey, it's the house. So there's that. But then also, then what's the point? You know, if all these stories are just the same and, there's a house. Oh, so is the joy in just seeing what the orison is going to be this time?
The orison is the reality they create.
Which, the theatre, the performance that they create.
Is orison a real word? Or is it just made up on this book?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
And again, though, it's just like, don't know.
It's never a good thing, in my view, when in a drama, whether it's TV or book, you're waiting for the penny to drop constantly. And in each story, except for the first, as you say, you're waiting for the penny to drop. And even in the last one, and I knew, see, the reveal in the last one, if you've read Bone Clocks, it ain't a reveal, which is that the woman who comes to visit.
The woman who comes to visit
actually knows more and knows exactly what's going on. She knows she's entering the horizon because she's part of the goodies from the Bone Clocks. To me, I knew from page three who she was. So, again, the penny for you may not have known because you wouldn't have
known. No, but again, he drops enough hints for you to realise.
That she's not a victim.
A, it's the last story in the book. So unless he's actually going to have five stories where people go into a house and die and that's it. Something has to change.
No, but she could have easily been a character clueless like everyone else but gets imbued by what the distilled remains of the souls that have already been and somehow from that.
But, she knows not to eat the strawberries and she makes the I mean, it's clear there's something different about her, even not having read the rest of Mitchell's.
Yeah, but I knew from, unfortunately for me.
But what you're saying is for someone who has, there's not even that. There's not even that experience of picking whether this character is different and what's going
to happen. That's not the penny for drop, it's the comeuppance. Okay, we'll get there. She'll finally reveal who she is and win. And you go, oh, well, that was fun. Okay, I'm done now.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed reading the first half of the book. I think those stories were told. The voice was very different in each story.
And by the way, character, what he does in three pages.
Oh, my God.
Adam Neville, which could do in a 400-page book.
Yes. I mean, David Mitchell's a good writer. Having read nothing else he's written, just with this book, even though I didn't particularly like the book and there's a lot of problems with it, it's quite clear this is a good writer. This is a writer who knows how to handle words. He knows how to build character very quickly and very in a way that makes these characters seem like real people and unique people in a way that the Neville does not. The characters in Neville's book are just caricatures. That's all they are and all they ever are.
Yep.
Whereas these characters in Mitchell's book feel like they could be real people in the world and they've got their own little differences, and part of that comes through with the change in voice that he has with each of them, because even though they're all third-person narratives, the voice changes.
Yes.
You know, the sentence structure changes, the words he used changes, the observations and perspective changes, all of that contributes.
For the second story, you've got a racist cop who's vile.
Yeah, I couldn't wait for him to die.
Yeah. But then you've got a bunch of young kids in the third one, and again, there's that sense of youth and exuberance. And,
all of that was appreciated. This was not a... Yeah, this was not a difficult book to read.
Yeah, this is something you can knock off in a night.
I did read it in one sitting. And all of that was nice, but at the end of it, it's like, and that chapter with the journalist and, oh my God, the exposition, oh my God.
This is what he does in Bone Clocks.
It made my eyes bleed.
Yeah, so let me give you some background here.
And then when you find out that again, it's like this is like James Bond villain final speech material, and it's in all of them, actually, in all of the novellas.
Yep.
There's this little speech by the two brother and sister who go back and forth about why are we doing it? This is why we're doing it, and it's like, oh my god,
it's the shittest part of Bone Clocks. In Bone Clocks, the last so Bone Clocks is, again, like Mitchell always does, is really a series of novellas.
Yep.
But they tell a coherent story, but have different characters running through, but they're not always the point of view character. The last, although there is one character who pops up in each story. Anyway, I'm not going to, this is not about Bone Clocks. Yeah. But the penultimate story is the Wodge of Exposition one. So prior to that one, brilliant character work, astounding stuff. There's a story that involves a journalist who's going to Afghanistan or Iraq, seeing war. It's just mind-blowingly brilliant. There's one about an author who's hated by everyone. Anyway, great stuff. Then you get essentially what you're talking about. I now have to explain the entire plot. Now, I personally loved it because I found it really interesting what the sort of world he was creating. But it is, it's exposition.
Yeah, I found it very uninteresting because the thing that I liked about Slate House as a book was that I liked that you despite the annoying little bits of, as you know, Bob's, or as you know, Nora, as the case may be, and Jonah, the brother and sister, which was in all of the novellas, but it wasn't incredibly long. They were just little bits. And what I liked about it was I liked the sort of shifting feeling that I didn't quite know what was going on. I didn't have to know. There's this spooky house which inhabits some other reality and bad things happen there. And that's as much as I need to know. I don't actually need to know the back history of the twins. I don't need to know that there's this cabal that has had a fissure and people have gone separate ways. I don't need to know that. I don't need to know any of that.
It's pointless anyway. I mean, you're about to drink this woman's soul. Well, who gives a shit?
It's so complicated. It's so complicated. And it, I have to say, this is like one of the, I guess critiques often thrown at genre fiction is the complexity of the fantastical elements and how often authors write books that are built on this massive tottering tower of complexity where they've had to make up all this different stuff and this thing to explain that and then that thing to explain the thing that they just explained and then another and it's just, it's so teachery and complicated. And I think about like the stories in the real world, so to speak, and how...
What do you mean? You mean like mimetic fiction that's based on the real world, or you're just...
No, like in the world, big complicated stories that we have in our world, like, I don't know, World War II.
just to pick one.
Just to pick
the
one.
Current American election cycle.
Right, and when I think about realist or mimetic fiction written about such things, they don't throw up a big, complex, teetering...
But they don't have to, Kirsten.
No, it's not the case of, I'm not talking about like throwing in exposition. I'm talking about the actual story. They're not that baroque in a sense, I guess. I guess, our stories are not that baroque.
Well, okay, but I mean,
conspiracy theories aside. Okay, sorry.
That's why when we talk about genre, we always focus on the world building because it's a thing that if we're a genre fan, it attracts us. And the more complicated the world building is, the more praise it gets from people for being so interlaid and structured and da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And that's now just become, whether it's a good or a symptom or a curse or a positive, it's now just become part of the landscape of genre.
Yeah, and it's something I find.
You can't just plonk a couple of elves in a secondary fantasy world and get away with it. Now I think the problem is that the world building has become so much that characters and any sort of innovation around plotting has gone out the window. Yeah. And now it's just all about the world building.
And I have to say, and this is a personal bias, admittedly, but the world building is the least interesting thing.
Yeah, you've always had that view, though.
So I'm saying it's like I don't mind the secondary world stuff, obviously. I don't mind the idea of this thing, but just that massive dump of exposition about and this huge, big, complicated for a very small book, for a book which is meant to be, by all accounts, a haunted house story, a ghost story, or as David Mitchell put it in one interview, a series of ghost story outcomes. Well, that last chapter doesn't belong.
Second last.
Sorry, the second last chapter doesn't belong in a series of ghost story outcomes.
No, I agree.
And where it does belong, clearly, is in David Mitchell's Greater World. And it's funny, there's one review I read on the New York Times by Scarlett Thomas.
It wasn't Dwight Garner?
No, this one is Scarlett Thomas.
Oh, they must have done two, because Dwight Garner wrote a review of Slatehouse.
There were multiple reviews of Slatehouse in the same publications. It's quite interesting, because they might do one on the Weekend Feature and then they'll do one
Of course, because Dwight writes for the gotcha.
But anyway, and what Thomas says, Slatehouse is what happens when authors start writing their own fan fiction. And I thought, that's perfect. And I got, you know, and that's what Slatehouse is. It's this part of David Mitchell's greater world, and he's telling a bit more backstory of this other book and filling in gaps, but it doesn't in itself make for a particularly successful book.
No, but how
book.
Much of it, and how much of this, first off, given that the first story started off as a Twitter thing, which I never looked at, but anyway, that's how it started. How much of this is that old Stephen King thing of I had a bit more fuel left in the car, and I'm just going to knock this thing off, and where is the issue then that Mitchell's written this? It's only 50,000 words. It's been taken seriously. It's been reviewed about 45,000 times.
Oh my God, the amount!
It isn't meant to be. No. But the thing is, I don't. David Mitchell is standing there with this book. Yeah, but he's not standing there saying, "I expect this to be a Man Booker nominee for this year." He's not thinking that this is the highlight of his career. This is not his magnum opus. This is whatever he had left in the engine after he'd finished Bone Clocks. That's what this is. Wait.
Sorry.
That's what this is.
Yep.
And yet, the literary world, because, as you said, it has his name on it, has treated it like it's the next major stepping stone in this career, which is a great career. He's written some amazing stuff. But, shit, everyone gets to, you know, slum it every so often. And it's not like he's written a 250,000-word novel that is a bit of frippery. It is genuinely a bit of frippery. That's 50,000 words. And, yeah, we're knocking it for being repetitive and doing all those things. But, fuck me, it's been treated like it's meant to be. And some of the reviewers have convoluted themselves to find a reason to have been reviewing this in the first place.
Do you want to hear my theory?
Was that a good rant?
Do you want to hear my theory?
All right.
My theory is that, and, you know, disclaimer, generalizations, blah, blah, blah. My theory is that literary readers and literary reviewers are as big a fan as genre readers and genre reviewers.
Oh, I don't think that's a theory. That's a fact.
This is fandom. This is literary fandom. This is, you know...
They just don't call it that.
No, but it's totally what it is. And I think I found what might be the the peak literary fandom article.
Ooh, okay.
This is Brian Finney with a review of the David Mitchell Uber novel. Brian Finney review, Slatehouse, in the LA Review of Books, which I quite like the LA Review of Books, actually. I'm just going to read this one paragraph. And he has, he's defending David Mitchell in a way from the reviewers and readers who don't like the fantastical elements in Mitchell's work, which is by no means all of them, but this is, I guess, the stance he's taking. And I'm just going to read this one paragraph because it's a thing of beauty. Like most of his novels, Slatehouse is a page-turner, fast-paced, hard to put down, and yet it is tightly constructed, offers a cast of varied, vividly portrayed characters, and has buried in it an ethical stance familiar to readers of the earlier novels, especially the persistence of predation in the history of civilization. This is what makes Mitchell so unusual. He combines literary sophistication with a talent for telling the kind of gripping story we normally associate with popular novelists. Rather like his American counterpart, Stephen King, he offers the best of both fictional worlds. This readability is probably what has prevented him from winning the Man Booker Prize while qualifying for the long list 5 times and the short list twice.
Fuck me.
So isn't that wonderful? Like, it's the perfect encapsulation. Like, literary books have ethics in them. Literary books are, you know, but you know, popular books are readable. And David Mitchell is doing both. It's this.
But every genre novel is about predation predation unique.
But this is the thing, as though genre novels can't, you know, tackle complicated ethics or morality or philosophy, and as though they don't, and as though every literary book does. You know, it's and further on in this, with this very lengthy review, Further on, he talks about again. He's talking about the references to you know, science fiction and other genres in the book, and there are a lot of them is embedded within each.
Well, it's a very
story.
It's a bit cringy, actually, some of the pop culture references.
Yeah,
because everyone's thought, oh, there's a Da Vinci Code reference. And...
Yeah, but he's referencing the type of novel that he's writing with each of those, so it's a framing device. And it was. But anyway, so what Finney says is, these accumulated references invite readers to treat the entire episode with the same indulgence they give to science fiction. Because that's how people read science. We just indulge it like it's a five-year-old coming out with a finger painting. And I'm just going to read you, I won't belabor the point, dear listeners, but I'll read you a few more examples which I think clearly show a literary fan, a fan of David Mitchell, bending over backwards to justify why the problems with this book and the genre cooties of this book are actually okay. So he says, at times there is too much explication of the supernatural cosmology put in the mouth of the twins, who already know what they're telling each other. Still, it's good, clean fun, and simultaneously Mitchell uses it to represent serious psychological and ethical issues.
Oh, fuck me. Stop. Please, so, God, don't. Please don't quote anymore.
No,
is there more?
It's important, right? So again, like, oh, way too much exposition, like what we were saying. But it's okay, because ethics. It's all about ethics and literary writing.
Because ethics. Yeah, what? Come on, finish it off.
So what makes this more than a supernatural yarn? Why does it have to be? But anyway. In the first instance, Mitchell treats the psychic and supernatural as a metaphor for the material and natural world.
No, he doesn't.
Because genre never does that.
Well, he does, but not in this book.
But I'm just saying.
No, but you're right. You're right. Yeah, genre does do it, and he's not doing it either.
Right. At the same, and there's a bit on, but I'll go forward. Yep. At the same time, Mitchell's images surreptitiously reinforce the view that humans are not in control of their thoughts or actions, because genre never plays with, you know, ideas of agency and autonomy and control
never.
And individuality.
No, it's just about ray guns and spaceships.
Mitchell's talent lies in his ability to infuse the supernatural with deep human feeling. It is the human in his work that makes those of us who enjoy his fantastic fictions swallow the fantasy willingly. Like I said, peak literary fan review. And I will link to it because it's just terrible.
But doesn't that...
But this is the whole thing. So you have a reviewer here who loves David, who's a big fan. He's a big fan. And he wants to try
and just... He's making the divide. He's
the
drawing
problem.
The line.
He is the problem.
He can take that line and shove it up
reviewers
his clacker.
Reviewers like that are the problem. But he's clearly got problems with Slade House. He doesn't want to have problems because he loves David's mission. He's a big fan. Huge fan. He says it all the way through. And so he's got to sort of do these contorting justifications for why all the bad exposition is actually okay and why all the supernatural elements actually do work because of the humanity. And it's just, it's so frustrating. And this is why I say that this is a fandom. This is clearly a fandom. And the fact that there are... papers and theses and reams and reams of research being done on David Mitchell, charting, no doubt with Venn diagrams, all of the interconnections between his novels and what character and what they mean and the layers and all that, is no different from people who learn Elvish in Lord of the Rings.
You're 100% correct. Absolutely correct.
And yet there's this like poo-pooiness about people who like this other type of non-realist fiction, when clearly one of the things that literary fans like about these types of books is the fantastical,
yeah.
Even if they don't want to admit that to themselves and have to try to justify it.
And as we've shown,
you know,
whether in the literary or genre camp, they can both be shit.
They can both be shit.
I mean, I think the Mitchell's a lot better, but it's still got major problems with it and
does.
They can both be complete
and
dog
as
shit.
You say, it kind of reminds me of like all of this fawning over Slade House, which is a good book. It has interesting things to say. It starts off very well and just kind of slides downhill on a raft of exposition. But it's a good book. I didn't, you know, apart from that penultimate chapter, I didn't mind reading it. And yet, as you say, like there's this influx of people who need to look at it and justify it and say why it's so brilliant and try to find...
No, to
it's
be
like
fair
people-
to a Dwight Garner, for example, in New York Times, he says this is pretty much, you know, this is not the great.
Oh yeah, and
Dan
it's
Michelin.
Like,
but why is he reviewing it in the first place? Or why is this not? You know,
aren't there,
you know,
better books?
Well, there are. And why?
Because it's
this,
the new David Mitchell.
Why isn't this like one of those box outs? You know how the review columns will have the box out of the book. That's why isn't this a one paragraph box out? Why is this a 500 word review from Dwight Garner, who's one of the major reviewers of the New York Times? Why? I don't get it.
Because it's the new David Mitchell.
Maybe Tor.com.
And this is fandom.
Maybe Tor.com does a bigger review because it's in our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. Maybe we also do a bloody 500, 10, 15 word review because it's not substantial enough.
It's not. If David Mitchell's name was on it, well, whoever's name would be on it, I guess, would get sued. But it's a good book. It has a very, very excellent opening novelette, and that's about what I can say about it. It was enjoyable to read for the most part, except for the end. And okay.
But
it certainly hasn't changed my life. It certainly, I still do want to read or watch Cloud Atlas.
No, read Cloud Atlas. I'm not going to hype it any further.
You know, like, it certainly hasn't put me off reading David Mitchell in the way.
Here's the thing.
The House of Small Shadows has put me
off. Read.
Yep.
I look at an Adam Neville book and I say, why was this ever written in the first place? What's this trying to do? That's not just new, but first off, what's it trying to say? Because it says nothing. What's it trying to do that's new with the genre it's playing with? Nothing. So what's the purpose of this book? Mitchell, this book is not an example. Mitchell is always trying to push something.
Yeah.
Whether it's the way you tell a story, whether it's the story itself, there's some sort of structural thing he's playing around with. He's giving he isn't just knocking something off. He's giving a reason for the book itself. And that is why he's an interesting writer. It's why he has a following. And the fact he started all this bloody Venn diagram shit by saying it's all one big Uber novel.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard him speak. I went and saw him last year. Very, very literate, very erudite, and very funny, and clearly a geek, clearly a genre person. But when he sits down at the typewriter and writes, he is trying something. He's playing with something.
And
that doesn't mean – that's not because he's a literary writer, by the way.
Yeah.
I've read a couple of literary novels last year and this year. What's the purpose of this book? Why does this exist? What's it trying to do? And I say the same of genre. When you sit down, what are you doing? What is your aim here?
Yeah. I'm going to say something that may be slightly controversial.
Well, don't stop because you're
doing. But I think it's actually the fault of the industry as a whole, in that I think overall on the level of and I'm not talking about story, and I'm not talking even really that much about structure. I'm talking about basic, I guess, prose work. On the whole, I think what we call literary novels are actually better written. Or should I put it, the novels that we get in the end. And I put that down to that I don't think publishing generally, as a rule, takes genre as seriously. I don't think these books get edited as well as books which are called
that
literary novels.
That is a pretty big bomb to end off a podcast because we're coming towards the end. It needs major unpacking.
Yeah. Put it this way.
But I happen to agree with you based on the many literary and genre novels I've read over the last 2 years.
Yep.
There is definitely a higher standard.
And there's not a huge investment. There's not a huge investment in as we know, in authors. And as we know, publishing these days is cutting costs right down to the bone. There's not massive amounts of editing done in a lot of books. I'm not talking about all of them. But I do think that for the most part, and possibly because it is seen as a luxury good, it is seen as a boutique type of item in that, genre books, which, you know, in Australia, if you sell 1,000 copies of a genre book, it's kind of a bestseller. That the idea is that where we will put the value is in polishing the prose and making sure the craft work just sings. And it is sad. I think there needs to be as much editorial attention paid to any book. I'm not saying that I think literary writers are better writers than genre writers. I'm saying their books get treated better at every level of publishing and marketing and reviewing than genre writers, and I think that's a problem, and it means that we're not getting the best genre books we could get. And again, it's a broad generalisation.
Point is, it's time to remove the divide, which will never happen because too many marketers need to market their stuff.
And hey, you know, as long as books like Adam Neville's are a bestseller, why should publishers do anything more?
No, you're right.
Yeah, if people are buying them and reading them and buying the next one, why should they spend any more time and money making the books better.
So about 3 minutes ago, I was getting quite angry. Now I'm really depressed. So thanks, Kirsten.
You're welcome.
That's a good point to end, I think.
I'm sure I'll get lots of nasty emails about that point.
Yeah, you probably won't. And if you do, you know. Well, this is the danger, and we're finishing now, but this is the danger of doing our curated podcasts, because there is no one supporting these novels. As in, I didn't come in recommending the Adam Neville saying this is the greatest piece of fiction I've read. And we've come in both going, oh, God. So that is going to – and that could be the next
– Nah, let's hope not.
For what we've got planned for the next 8-9 months, there could be more of this sort of podcast.
No, there could be. There could be. But I think that's fine.
Let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up.
Apparently you have to catch a train or something. I don't know.
I do have to catch a train to go all the way back to the wilds of Ballarat. So next episode we are looking at two fairly newish anthologies. One's really new. The other one I think was out early last year.
Yes.
They are The Sea's Ours, Tales from Steampunk Southeast Asia, which is edited by Jamie Goh and Joyce Chang. And Afro-SF, Science Fiction by African Writers, which is edited by Ivor W. Hartman. And I am quite keen to read them both, actually. The steampunk one I came across not so long ago, and it sounds really interesting because, as you know, Ian, not a huge fan of steampunk.
I can't stand it.
I know, mostly for the horrible colonialist narratives that run largely unchallenged.
That's one of the reasons. I just don't like that stuff. But that's why this will be fascinating.
So this will be quite fascinating, I think. And you nominated the Afro-SF book.
Did I?
Yeah, you said, well, we could match it with this one.
Oh, I did too. Yeah. There you go. Good on me.
So I'm looking forward to reading both of them. So that's anthologies next month, which should be fun. I always like reviewing anthologies because they're very light on the spoilers. Because you have many stories to get through, so, you know.
Keep going.
And I guess the other big news is that our Patreon account is now live.
That is fantastic.
That is fantastic.
We expect to see the money absolutely rolling in, gazillions of it.
Actually, you know, I still don't actually know how it works about the money, like, because it's all in US and I gave them my bank account or my PayPal account.
Certain,
so I guess
you
it
can
goes
email
to me
Tansy
I'll work
or
it out.
Lisa or someone and they'll tell you.
Yeah, anyway, so yes, we've put up some milestone goals. I'll put the link in the show notes, or else I'm sure you can Google Patreon and Writer and Critic. Yeah, you can donate as little money as you want. We've started at just $1, which is awesome. And if you give us $1 an episode, they're all just per episode. And we're only doing 10 or maybe 11 of them a year.
So it's about 11, maximum $11 outlay.
Yeah. And of course, we'll thank you, unless you don't want us to, and then we won't.
What, if each of the end of each podcast is going to thank everyone who...
Well, everyone, any new patrons will thank them, unless they don't, and that's okay. If you pledge $2, then you will get to vote on two books that we're going to be discussing on a special Patrons' Choice episode, which I'm actually really excited about. I like the idea of our listeners choosing the books.
It didn't go so well last time we did that.
No, that was a special self-published episode.
Which we're never doing again.
And if you've pledged $3 or more per podcast, then you'll be one of the patrons who get to actually create the list of books from which everyone will get to vote to see what we what we have to read.
Wow.
And so you can nominate and vote for anything you like, obviously, but it'd be really nice if you didn't nominate books that you know we'd hate just to hear us do another podcast like this one.
Yeah, that'd be good. By the way, I don't remember reviewing any of these options that you've put up. So these
I totally did. I totally sent them to you. It's not my fault that you just skim my emails and go, yeah, okay. I definitely sent you this one.
Oh, yeah, which is?
Special one, which I don't actually expect too many people to take up. But $10 per podcast means that I will either make you something or Ian will sing you a song.
I will, and I'm thinking through what I will sing.
Yes, and we will, and Ian will send you that song on an MP3, and you can do whatever you want with
it. Throw it in the bin, which is probably what I would do with it. But anyway, yeah,
Or you can get me to make you something, and I'll make you maybe a piece of jewelry or a card.
I think you're going
to
get more value out of what Kirsten does for you than you singing.
Well, I don't know. They could probably do a lot with like a 2-minute MP3 of you singing "Boys of Summer."
Boys of Summer?
Isn't that? Oh, no, it's Summer of 69. Sorry.
For God's sake.
Boys of Summer. Boys of Summer.
No, maybe I'll do Meatloaf. You know, the Rearview Mirror Paradox. Well, I mean, whatever that song's called. Anyway, yeah, keep going.
So anyway, so that's that. And you'll get one thing a year for people who, you know, support us at $10 a podcast for at least 6 months. You'll get a thing or a song every year. And, of course, our undying love and gratitude, because that would be awesome. And what are we doing with the money, Ian, apart from, you know, going out and getting drunk? we should do a wine post.
Didn't we say that this little laptop you use is literally on the – I mean, the equipment. It's all going to be on – it's going to go on the equipment, because even the microphone stands we're using right now
they're on their way out.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's to pay for things like hosting, and if you get enough, we'll get new equipment.
Yeah.
And then really exciting, if we get up to the level of actually $150 a podcast, then we will commit to producing one live podcast every year with special guests, hopefully to be recorded at the Australian National Science Fiction Convention.
Wherever that may be.
Or a similar convention that we can get to, and that will be fun.
Yes. So that requires $150.
To pay for our airfares and stuff to get to a convention. This is pie in the sky, like, dreams that you'll never ever have kind of thing. But, you know, I thought if we end up with a whole bunch of people who give us lots of money, we should like put a big goal out there. So we get enough money per month, and I think it's what, about $400 or something.
$400
ridiculous
bucks.
Amount. We're going to do a podcast tour, and we're going to go around Australia.
Yeah.
No one will ever give us $400 a month, Ian. Don't worry.
Look, you won't break my heart if we don't reach $400 a month. All right?
Saying. It's just out there. Because you don't want people to think if once we get over $100 and something, then the rest of the money is just, you know, we beer and Skittles.
But that's the whole point of Patreon, for people to live off this. It's beer and Skittles. It's not to come up with crazy lunacy like, anyway, no, yeah, I've committed to it. I don't know what I'm committing to, but I've committed to it. Anyway.
So that's our Patreon. Page. Again, link in the show notes, or I'm sure you can search for us on Patreon and we'll be there. And thank you in advance for anyone who contributes and gives us even a dollar a podcast.
I'll take a dollar.
That would be great, because everything goes towards me not having to pay the hosting fees anymore, which would be good.
Don't I give you money?
No.
Why don't you ask?
I don't think
about it. Why are we having a personal conversation on the podcast?
Okay, and that's it, I think. That's it, we're done. Two books that we went, about.
Well, I think we shat on one from a reasonably high height. The other one we were a little bit more
meh. I don't think it was that high. I think we were both down there on the ground with trousers down.
So in March, the next one. Shit, that's not far away.
We're monthly now, remember? Begged me for 2 years to go back to monthly.
Yes, and I'm really excited about it.
Yes. So two hopefully great anthologies that I'm definitely looking forward to reading. And I guess we'll see everybody in a few weeks.
Bye.
Yeah. We won't see anybody. I don't know why I say that.
Do I have to say bye again?
They never see us either.
No, well, they can imagine.
They hear us.
They can. Bye.
Bye. Every 2 or 3 days. Oh, there's Safehouse. It's so ridiculous.
I have no idea why that's happening.
The Slate House is haunting my email.
Wouldn't it be funny if
there's
I was
really,
just doing
really
it?
There's a really, really dull horror story in there. And I'm not going to write it.
So you don't think it's funny that I might actually just be doing it, just sending it to you?
Sure. If you're getting up at 1:53 a.m. every second morning to send me an empty email, go for it. Married life is treating you well.
yeah.